It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look back at a group of Wisconsin women who pushed for the right to vote. First, milk on the school lunch tray is in the news again. A pair of U.S. senators, including Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, proposed new legislation last week that would allow schools to serve whole milk and 2% milk, including flavored versions of both of those. This comes after Obama-era regulations pulled milk with higher fat content out of schools. Senator Johnson cites a big downturn in milk consumption, including among students nationwide, as a result. He says kids should be able to make the choice of milk that makes the most sense for them. We're going to get a couple perspectives on this proposed legislation, and then we want to hear your thoughts on school lunches and the role of different kinds of milk in them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Shelley Meyer joins us now. She's executive director with the Professional Dairy Producers of Wisconsin. Shelley, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts on this proposed legislation from Senator Johnson?
I think it's great. I think it's logical, and I think it'll be good for our kids.
It may be difficult to predict at this point, but do you see this having an effect on how much milk kids drink in schools?
Well, I think that whenever milk is served and it's got, you know, the option of being either whole milk, which is 3.25% butterfat, it's got a good taste to it. And if they can get some flavored milk into schools, the big thing is that milk is handled properly at the, all the way through transportation and to the time that it's delivered to the kids and it's ice cold. Absolutely, because good milk tastes good.
And what kind of impact could this have on dairy producers here in Wisconsin?
It's a little hard to say, but any time that our products are being shared and consumed, I mean, that it certainly isn't going to hurt our milk price at all. But the biggest thing is, as a dairy farmer right now, especially in Wisconsin, for people to understand, 90% of our milk in Wisconsin goes into cheese. But really, our market is a global market. But the biggest thing for me as a dairy farmer is knowing that the product that I am producing in dairy is being appreciated and consumed. And there's a real benefit to our children of our all over our country that they're getting enough calcium and good protein and nutrition, and I feel good about that. So getting it back into the schools is not only the right thing to do, but it's just makes common sense, and it should happen.
Can you explain a little more of how we end up with these four kinds of milk, the whole, the 2%, the 1%, and the skim?
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the most misunderstood things about milk is what it really is when they talk about whole milk. Whole milk is standardized. It always has the same amount of butterfat in it when it comes to you as a consumer, and that is it's standardized, so there's 3.25% butterfat in it. The rest of it is protein and the 9 essential nutrients that are in it, and the rest of it is the water that makes up the milk. And so whole milk is 3.25. 2% milk has been standardized, so some of the butterfat has been skimmed off. It's 2%, which the whole milk is 96.75% fat-free. 2% is 98% fat-free. 1% is 99% fat-free, and skim milk has no butterfat in it at all. If you're a dairy snob like I am, who has grown up on the freshest and the best whole milk, we can usually kind of taste the difference. Whole milk has a little bit more, I would say, body to it, a little more of a full feel and flavor to it. The biggest thing to know about butterfat is it has some of those essential nutrients that we need, and it helps you absorb your vitamins and your minerals. There's benefits to it also.
And Shelley, before we let you go, you mentioned that most of our milk here, produced here in Wisconsin, goes into cheese. Do you have thoughts on school lunch programs for non-liquid dairy when it comes to cheese, yogurt, and other products?
Oh, you know, yes, yogurt and cheese is loaded with good things that kids need, protein, those fats, those nutrients. So if regardless of how they're getting dairy, they need to get dairy so that they have these things that they need to grow. A growing body needs protein and calcium. You have one chance to build your skeletal structure. And our kids, a lot of our kids, unfortunately, are not getting the nutrition that they need at home, like a good breakfast or a stable family life. So that school lunch program is the only time that they might get a decent meal. So getting their milk and their protein and these essential vitamins into them so they build a strong skeletal muscle is critical to the health of our country and the health of our kids.
Shelley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Shelley Meyer, Executive Director of the Professional Dairy Producers of Wisconsin. Beth Olson joins us now for a look at the nutritional side of milk on the lunch tray. Beth is an associate professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison, where she focuses on nutrition, education, and health behavior. Beth, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
You're very welcome.
Before we get into milk in particular, I want to pick up on something that Shelley said, the role of school lunches in the overall nutritional outlook for kids. We get worked up about what's on the school lunch tray. Is there a good reason for that?
Yes, it's very important that children have access to a good school lunch. And in fact, there was some excellent data just released by USDA in spring comparing intakes of foods and nutrients among kids both before and after the changes came to the school lunch program, but also between kids who participate and don't. And the most glaring differences I felt existed were those kids who participated versus those who didn't. So the kids who participated in the school lunch program had much higher intakes of fruits and vegetables, dairy, other good foods compared to those that don't. The difference was really striking.
So that would be compared to those who brown bag it or bring their lunchbox in.
Exactly.
Now, let's look at milk in particular. Is milk, in whatever form, before we get into the fat percentage, milk a pretty solid nutritional aspect of a lunch for kids?
It's a very important aspect. It doesn't mean that every child would need to have milk. There will be some children who would have an allergy or an intolerance, some of the reason that they couldn't have it. But overall, dairy is an excellent package of nutrients, as Shelley mentioned. Protein, vitamin D, calcium, potassium, B vitamins. It's a great source of nutrients.
There's been back and forth now from the Obama administration and now under the Trump administration over fat levels in milk. So that's the skim 1%, 2% whole, and flavored milk, chocolate milk, more sugary stuff. Let's start with fat levels. Is there enough of a difference that we should be worked up about it?
I think there is. We have to look at the diet as a whole. So, of course, we're looking at all sources of fat in the diet, especially now for kids and for our population where we have a great problem with children being overweight, having diseases that we used to think didn't occur in people until they were older, children now have. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to add fat and calories into their diets when we have been successful at removing some of them. And so I think the argument should be more about how do we get kids to consume dairy, period, than encouraging trying to do that by putting more fat and saturated fat and calories into their school lunch program.
Well, one concern in a press release from Senator Johnson in backing this legislation was, okay, there's going to be some kids who don't like the skim or 1% milk if they don't have a 2% or whole milk option, or maybe a flavored milk option, they're going to drink, what, soda or something bad.
And I'm not terribly concerned with his idea of introducing a bit more flavored milk into the school lunch program. There is already flavored milk in the school lunch program. I would be less enthusiastic about adding the whole milk back in. I wasn't able to find really solid data that said that milk consumption in the school lunch program has gone down significantly. In fact, what they often call plate waste for various foods has been pretty stable, including for milk. And the number one product wasted in the school lunch program is actually vegetables.
How can we get kids to eat more of their vegetables in a school lunch program?
Vegetables has been a hard nut to crack, if you will. Over time, for many people, we've had more
parents
luck getting
included.
We've had more luck getting kids to eat fruit than vegetables. I think a lot of schools, and in fact, this legislation introduced the idea of school wellness policies. So there are many things that encourage kids to eat more fruits and vegetables in school overall. Farm to school, school gardening programs. Kids are a lot more interested when they see where it comes from. The ability to taste a lot of different variety of vegetables, you know, some old, but enduring data on it can take several, many, many tries for kids to try it before they'll eat a new vegetable. So I think just keeping them available, a wide variety, introducing them over and over, and then doing nutrition education. Kids are actually, especially at younger ages, quite interested in how, as Shelley mentioned, food helps them grow and perform better.
How about the junk food in schools, the stuff that everybody agrees is probably bad, candy bars, soda, chips and things like that? What is the state of the art now with those being present or absent in schools?
So I think there's a lot less than there used to be. That was some of the requirements that have been put in place over the years for school lunch programs, is that they couldn't offer competitive foods that were unhealthy at the same time as children would be getting the school lunch and breakfast program. And I think one of the interesting pieces of information I saw, which I found very encouraging, is there used to be a bigger disparity between the quality of both competitive and school lunch program meals available to children in lower income or minority and small schools, and those in wealthier areas or schools that had more white children. And that disparity has actually gone down considerably. So we're seeing that the total environment is not only healthier, it's healthier for more and more kids.
If you were talking to Congress, what would you say is your top priority for nutrition in our school lunches right now?
It would be getting children to participate in the school lunch program. So we have in some schools maybe only half of the children participating. And as I mentioned earlier, the difference in the quality of the meals between those who participate and those who don't is striking, including a huge difference in how much milk they drink. And there are some programs available that school districts can investigate, particularly if they have children who are lower income in their school district, where they can offer free lunch to every child in their school district. That removes a lot of stigma to participating in the school lunch program, and it tends to get more children, particularly low-income children, participating.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Beth Olson, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department, focusing on nutrition education and health behavior. Been talking about new proposed national legislation that would increase the variety of milk schools can offer as part of their lunch programs. That would include bringing 2% in whole milk back into school lunches. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson from here in the state is one of the sponsors of that. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a milk drinker at home or at school? What do you think a school should have on the tray when it comes to milk? Do you like this idea of bringing in the higher fat milk? The idea, Senator Johnson, hoping to get more kids to drink milk along the way. Are you a dairy farmer? What do you think of all this? Have you switched wherever you are, at home or at school, to non-dairy milk-like substances? Some controversy over the names of those beverages. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Devin is with us in Milwaukee. Devin, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I graduated from high school recently, so I'm not going to be drinking milk at school pretty soon, but I used to drink the chocolate milk every day, and it was pretty good. I mean, I support milk in school. I think it's good. I remember when they used to have the strawberry milk. I kind of missed that.
I liked strawberry back in the day myself. Now, Devin, for you, was it a thing where if they didn't have chocolate milk, you wouldn't have had milk, drank milk at all?
Well, I would just ask them, because usually they had another cart or another crate full of chocolate milk. But if they didn't have it, then I would just drink the regular milk, I guess.
All right. Now you're done with high school. Congratulations. Are you still a milk drinker, even if it's not on a school lunch tray being handed to you?
Yeah, I do like milk. My parents, though, they like the coconut milk. I hate the coconut milk, but I have to drink it.
All right. Hopefully you can compromise with your family at home, get a little of both. Devin, thank you so much for calling in and getting us started.
Yeah.
Now we'll go to Amanda on the line with us in Madison. Amanda, hello.
Hi. So I have a daughter who is in 5K, and she drinks milk at school every day. Unfortunately, she is lactose intolerant. So I guess I was kind of wondering why there aren't really very many options for non-dairy milk in schools so that kids can be getting their calcium if they have lactose intolerance or milk protein.
So she's lactose intolerant and she still drinks the milk at school?
She does, yes. Because she is six.
Okay, fair. Okay. Have you talked to anybody about that, if there are options for that? I haven't, I hadn't heard about that being an option, you know, schools offering alternatives to milk.
Yeah, so I haven't really heard anything about that either. And I also was wondering if maybe adding flavored milk was going to be too much sugar in kids' diets. Because as a parent, I'm always trying to reduce that.
All right. Well, Amanda, thanks for calling and good luck to your daughter. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Our starting point, legislation proposed by Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, saying, hey, we're going to let schools, if this passes, we're going to let schools serve all kinds of milk, 2% and whole milk, as well as flavored versions of those. Asking for your thoughts on that idea at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on the great milk debates, what should be available on the school lunch tray. Again, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Linda is with us next in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I've grown up in Wisconsin. I'm almost 60. Most of my life drinking whole milk because could get it from a relative that was a dairy farmer and whatnot. As I've gotten older and health problems and whatnot, I've had to change to a milk alternative for lower sugar. But I do full-fat yogurt, full-fat cheese. I just got to watch the sodium. And I find that's a nice balance. My take on it is there's nothing wrong with plain whole milk. Once you start adding flavors, that's when the sugar comes in. And the sugar is more likely to lead to the obesity than the fat is, because the fat is going to keep you full. And you don't want to, you know, if you've got a full tummy, you don't go wandering.
And Linda, do you miss that whole milk now that you can't drink it like you used to?
Well, like I said, it's because of the sugar content.
Mm-hmm.
Now, purified, there's ultra purified milk. Then I can have whole milk because there's less sugar.
Oh, okay.
But that's expensive.
Gotcha.
In fact, I bought yogurt yesterday that's 3 grams of carbohydrate, including sugar, and 26 grams of protein.
Hmm.
That's great, but it's you can only get small amounts because it's expensive.
Linda, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Lisa is on the line in Wausau. Lisa, hello.
Yes, I think they should serve almond and soy milk. There are a lot of children in the school system who do have milk allergies, and the flavors would be good. Rarely do children take white milk in the school system. You see them taking chocolate milk. I wish they'd offer strawberry milk again also. There's not really that much sugar in a carton of milk, so you're not really going to get the amount of sugar that some parents might think you are. Another option, I think, and I know we're talking about milk, but would be some orange juice for those kids who are lactose intolerant.
And Lisa, you mentioned we see this. Do you work in schools yourself?
I do.
Oh, in the nutrition department?
No, in teaching department.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you so much for sharing what you've seen there, Lisa. I appreciate that. We are asking for your input on milk on the school lunch tray at 800-642-1234. Senator Ron Johnson is co-sponsoring a bill that would allow schools to include whole milk and 2% milk as options. They couldn't anymore under an Obama-era change. Now it's the skim or the 1%. You can get flavors. You can get chocolate in those. The new change would allow 2% whole and flavors thereof. Back to another caller now. Frank is on the line in Eau Claire. Frank, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, you know what? I support the legislation. I think it's a great idea to have that, I mean, for the dairy farmers and everything else. But I guess the thing that strikes me is that Ron Johnson and Barack Obama, neither one of those guys was a nutritionist. Where do they come down on this? I think there absolutely should be, you know, variety in school for those choices. But what do the people actually know about? What are they saying?
Right. Thanks a lot for the call, Frank. Yeah, we heard from a nutritionist earlier, not so much on board with a higher fat milk due to higher calories, she said, and some saturated fat concerns. One more caller, maybe a couple more callers. Matt is with us now in Madison. Matt, hello.
Yeah, hello. I would weigh in on the side of taking any opportunity to not introduce sugars into the kids' diet. So, you know, don't introduce those sugary milks, even if it's just a little bit.
So like the chocolate and strawberry milks that people have been talking about.
Yeah, I read an article in National Geographic a while back, and I don't recall the numbers, but bottom line is Americans consume way more sugar every day than they need to. And it's clear when you look around. And I think any opportunity to not make that move is something we should do, you know.
Matt, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go now to Alice in New London. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Alice?
Well, I've been there and done that. I've worked in a food program, a student food program, and I don't think most people, and I don't think Senator Johnson has considered the tremendous amount of wastage that you would probably find if you have to start offering a half a dozen different kinds of milk. I think if kids want strawberry milk or chocolate milk, they should get it at home. And if they can't get it at home because their parents don't want them to have it, well, then they probably shouldn't be choosing it at school. And if you have to keep production records and consumption records for things like this, and if you've got half a dozen different kinds of milk that you have to have extra space to store and extra effort by the staff to keep track of, I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of waste, both in time and money.
Alice, thanks a lot for sharing your experience right up front there. Thanks to everyone for your calls. And thanks to our guests, Shelley Meyer, Executive Director of the Professional Dairy Producers of Wisconsin. We also heard from Beth Olson, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Department, talking about a possible change in school lunches when it comes to milk. What kind of milk can be on the tray? U.S. Senator Ron Johnson co-sponsoring legislation on that. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is celebrating the 100th anniversary of becoming the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. Today we learn about the roles that some women with Wisconsin connections played when it came to the suffrage movement. Meg Jones is a reporter who specializes in military and veterans issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's also the author of the book World War II Milwaukee. She wrote about profiled six women who were connected to the suffrage movement. Meg, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Before we meet some of the women you profiled, Meg, let's talk about Wisconsin's role here. We were, and we've talked about this on the show, the first state to officially ratify the 19th Amendment, but there were some fits and starts with trying to legalize women voting before that, right?
Exactly. It's kind of ironic that Wisconsin would be the first, considering that right up until that point, women had really not ever gotten the right to vote here in Wisconsin, even though dating back to 1869, women in Wyoming could vote. And even in 1916, 3 years before Wisconsin ratified to vote, 4 million women across the United States could vote for president and other offices, including in Illinois, but not in Wisconsin. So it's kind of interesting how long it took and how many times it went to referendums and to votes, and but yet there was a small but very dedicated cadre of activists who were fighting for that, and not coincidentally they were all women.
Well, let's meet some of them now. Laura Ross Walcott, I guess Dr. Laura Ross Walcott, the first, you write, female physician in Wisconsin and first president of the Wisconsin Women's Suffrage Association. Can you share some of her story?
Yeah. So the thing about Laura Ross Walcott was that she moved to Milwaukee in 1857, and it was here in Milwaukee where she worked as a consulting physician at hospitals and medical schools. But the sad part about Laura Ross Walcott was that when she went to join the Medical Society of Milwaukee County, they said no. And when she asked why, they said, because you're a woman. And she was like, but I'm a doctor. And they're like, yeah, we don't care. So she became very active in the Women's Suffrage Association. In fact, this is in the 1850s. She was the first president of the Wisconsin Women's Suffrage Association. It was under her leadership that kind of expanded the group from just a small but dedicated group here in Milwaukee throughout to chapters throughout the state. And she was the one that organized the first women's suffrage convention in the state, which was here in Milwaukee at Milwaukee City Hall. That was in 1869, and that's the convention that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton attended. And she was also very instrumental in campaigning for the right of higher education for women, because at the time, the University of Wisconsin was segregated. It wasn't that men and women weren't being taught together at the University of Wisconsin. And she said, you know, that's one of the petty ways in which women are defrauded their rights, because they aren't getting their an education. And the sad part about Laura Ross Walcott, here's this woman who's so instrumental in Wisconsin women getting the right to vote, but she died in 1915. So she was never able to vote in for a presidential election.
And her story points toward this being a multi-generational battle. It wasn't just something that blew up after 1900.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, there's women like what's interesting. It kind of started as women's clubs. That the women's clubs were kind of instrumental in this. And so you had, there's a woman by the name of Olympia Brown, is a fascinating woman. She's the first female ordained minister, not just in Wisconsin, but in all of the United States. And she was a pastor at a church in Racine, and Wisconsin, it was men voters, did agree to allow women to vote they passed in 1886, and they were first allowed to vote in 1887, but only for educational, like for school boards, because the men's thinking was like, well, you know, women are raising children, they should have a say in school boards, but they couldn't vote for anything else. So at that first vote in 1887, it wasn't very clear amongst county clerks all across the state who could vote for what. And so some ballots were tossed out, some women showed up to vote and they were turned away. And Olympia Brown's ballot, which she was very proud to vote for, vote in this 1887 election, it was tossed out. Well, she didn't just let it lie there. She filed a lawsuit saying, hey, my rights are infringed as a voter. She was able to get a county judge to vote in her favor. But then it went to the Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court basically punted. And they said, you know what, that the law that allowed women to vote for school boards is vague. So they basically sent it back to the legislature and said, well, okay, do a better job of writing this. And coincidentally or not, it took another 10 years for the legislature to, like, even rewrite another law. And in the meantime, that was Brown, who was, you know, she kept giving speeches supporting women's suffrage. And she did live long enough to vote in the 1920 election.
We are looking back at Wisconsin women who played a big role in the women's suffrage movement, this year being the 100-year anniversary of Wisconsin being the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. Meg Jones is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She profiled some Wisconsin women who played a big role in that movement. Richland Center native Ada James was active. She started as early as high school, you write. What kind of efforts did she make?
Well, Ada James was noteworthy in that she was one of the many people who were trying to campaign for suffrage, but she came up with some very inventive ways to kind of get out the word. So, for example, she was able to hire a boat to distribute suffrage leaflets on the Wolf River, and she hired an airplane to drop leaflets on crowds at county fairs. So Ada James is kind of interesting in how she was able to get this, you know, to get the word out. What was interesting about Ada James was that, and so she played a very integral part on the day that Wisconsin was the first to ratify the vote, because her dad had been a state senator in Wisconsin. In fact, he had sponsored a 1912 referendum, which ultimately failed, that would have given women suffrage here in Wisconsin. And so picture this. So on that day, on June 10th, 1919, there's only like three states whose legislatures are still in session, and that includes Wisconsin. And Wisconsin's legislature should not have been in session, actually. They had run too late. They were late. So they were still in session, and I was able to find the Milwaukee Journal article on that day, and it showed that that Wisconsin was ratified their paperwork at like 11:52, I think it was. But unfortunately, the Illinois legislature, they had passed it at 10:48, but a.m. on that same day. But that doesn't matter that they've approved it at the state house level. They've got to get their paperwork out to this Department of State out in Washington, D.C. So Ada James gets her dad to speed out to Washington, D.C. She even gives him her traveling bag, a little suitcase, and said, "Dad, here, take it." And so he gets, you know, car and train, and he gets to Washington, D.C. And fortunately for Wisconsin's history, when Illinois got their paperwork out there, there was an error in the paperwork. And so Wisconsin ended up being the top one, the first.
Meg, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Meg Jones, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about Wisconsin women involved in the women's suffrage movement. You can see her profiles of more of those women over at jsonline.com. After months of anticipation, Facebook says it's going to launch its own digital currency. It's called Libra. It's intended to be sent anywhere in the world without costly fees. Developers say users will be able to keep Libra in a digital wallet that will be available in third-party apps. Facebook says the goal is to bring cryptocurrency into the mainstream, but the company says it isn't going to oversee Libra directly, at least not by itself. It'll be Facebook and 26 other partners, including Visa and MasterCard. Facebook says it will begin offering accounts next year through a new subsidiary called Calibra. David Marcus, the head of Calibra, told CNBC this morning that people shouldn't fear Facebook gaining access to their financial information.
And to earn people's trust, we are going to have to make strong commitments, notably on privacy, ensuring that financial data and social data never get commingled, and really, you know, earn people's right. trust over very long periods of time, because there are going to be a number of wallets that are going to compete with us right. on the network we helped create.
So what can people use Libra for when it is put into practice? And how does this stack up against Bitcoin and the other digital currencies already on the market? Mike Chappell is an associate teaching professor of information technology, analytics, and operations at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. He's an expert in cybersecurity and online privacy. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be with you.
Before we get too deep into Libra, this new project from Facebook, can you explain the basic idea behind a cryptocurrency?
Sure, Rob. Cryptocurrency is essentially just an attempt to create the digital version of cash. Right. When we use cash every day, we do it because it's easy. Everybody accepts it. Everybody understands how to use it. And you don't really need any special tools to do so. Right. You can just have cash in your wallet and hand it to somebody, and everybody recognizes that value. What a cryptocurrency attempts to do is create some of that same convenience online, where we can have digital tokens, coins that we can exchange with other people for goods and services.
Why do we need that, though? I can have a bank account that I can make payments with online, digitally, in dollar form. Why do I need something other than a dollar or a euro or a yen to do that?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of reasons. First, you and I might have bank accounts and credit cards, but not everybody does. There's a substantial number of people in the world who are unbanked and don't have access to those same types of resources that we do. And maybe they do have access to a mobile phone, you know, especially in parts of the developing world. Mobile technology is coming, is spreading much faster than banking technology. So, you know, there's certainly that group of people who don't have that. And then one of the other driving forces behind some cryptocurrencies is anonymity. So when you engage in a transaction using your credit card or your bank account, there's then a digital trail that ties you to that transaction. And we don't have that when we use cash. And with some cryptocurrencies, that anonymity exists, and people can engage in transactions online without having that digital trail.
The big point of comparison people might have heard of so far is Bitcoin. How does that mm-hmm. one work in particular?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is the dominant cryptocurrency today. It hasn't actually picked up in widespread adoption the way it looks like Libra might. And there's a few reasons behind that. I think the first one is that it's fairly difficult to use Bitcoin. If you want to go and purchase a Bitcoin and then manage it in a Bitcoin wallet, you have to have a little bit of technical knowledge and really understand what you're doing. And the idea behind Libra is maybe resolving some of that, because Facebook and the other companies behind Libra really understand user design and making things simple. So that ease of use is the first thing. I think the second barrier that stopped Bitcoin from becoming widely adopted is it's very, very volatile. The price of Bitcoin jumps all over the place. And this makes merchants very hesitant to use it. It's difficult to price something in Bitcoin because the price of Bitcoin itself swings all over the place. Like I just looked this morning, and a Bitcoin today is worth about $9,000. And this time last week, it was worth $7,900. And you know, who knows what it's going to be worth next week? There's no peg to the price of a Bitcoin. It's just swinging as market demand swings.
And that takes us to Libra, which Facebook and a bunch of other companies and some nonprofits are teaming up on. They're taking a different approach. And one of their goals is to not have that swingy up and down value, right?
Right. I think that's one of the most appealing aspects of Libra. They're not trying to create a currency that has its own intrinsic value, like we're trying with, like the Bitcoin developers try to do, right, where Bitcoin is worth something because people want Bitcoin. And instead, they're trying to derive the value of Libra off of the value of existing currencies. So when you buy a Libra, the money that you use to purchase your coin is placed into a reserve account. And then that reserve account is used to create the value of Libra itself. And if you later decide you want to cash in your Libra for dollars or euros or yen, that money is taken out of that reserve account and given back to you, and the Libra is destroyed. So it's kind of an attempt to go back to something similar to the gold standard, right? At one point in U.S. history, there was enough gold in Fort Knox to back the value of every U.S. dollar that was printed. Now, of course, the U.S. economy has long since left that gold standard, but this is one of the best ways to establish the value of a new currency. So with Libra, it's establishing that value by creating a reserve of existing accepted stable currencies. It's the dollar, the euro, the yen, the franc, and the pound.
Talking to Mike Chappell from the University of Notre Dame about a new currency being released by a partnership of companies, most prominently Facebook. Mike, take us into the driver's seat. Suppose I'm a consumer, Libra has rolled out. What do I do? How do I use it?
Well, so we don't know all of those details yet. One of the important things to note is that you can't go use Libra today. Right now, it's still a proposal, but there's a very strong group of companies behind this proposal: Facebook, PayPal, eBay, Uber, Lyft, and quite a few others. What we're likely to see is many of these technology partners creating ways to be able to access and use Libra. So we've already heard that Facebook is going to integrate it into Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp. So you'd be able to have a store of Libra within a wallet, and a digital wallet that you can access through these applications. So there does have to be some intermediary to help you exchange this money with other people.
One concern people have already raised is, hey, aren't we worried about privacy concerns with Facebook and other social media companies already? What happens when their apps have access to our financial transactions?
I think that's a very reasonable concern, Rob. It's something I would be worried about myself, right? So when you look at some cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin that we spoke about earlier, they're designed around anonymity. So Libra uses the same fundamental technology that Bitcoin uses, something called the blockchain, that allows for the idea of anonymized transactions. But the catch is you need some technology platform to help you access that cash. With Bitcoin, you can manage that on your own computer if you want, or you can use a service to do so. With Libra, it looks like you're going to have to use one of these technology partners. So if you decide to use Facebook Messenger to send Libra coins back and forth with other people, Facebook's going to have a record of that. So I think there is a reasonable privacy concern there.
How about potential misuse of this currency? It seems like anytime you design something related to money and social media, somebody figures out a way to do bad stuff with it.
I think that's true. With any way value is exchanged, there's always some sort of criminal element associated with it. And that's actually been one of the major criticisms of Bitcoin. Because of the anonymity of Bitcoin and other currencies, some of the major uses, there's really two things that it seems like most Bitcoin transactions involve. One of those is speculation, people trying to invest in this wildly volatile value of a Bitcoin. And the other one is activity that they don't want traced to them because, frankly, it's illegal. I think Bitcoin's major association is with like drug sales and other illicit transactions on the internet. One of the things that it looks like Libra is planning on doing is having some identity validation. There's some signs in their documentation that there's going to be a registration process, and you're going to have to prove your identity just like you would when you get a bank account before you can access the Libra ecosystem.
Let's talk about the unbanked population you touched on earlier. I know there's at least one big international nonprofit, maybe a couple, on the list of people involved here. How could this Libra be used for people, say, in developing countries who don't have access to ready banking?
I think this is one of the most interesting possible uses of Libra, being able to, if people have a smartphone and access to Facebook or one of these other platforms that might grow to support Libra, they can store the value of their Libra on those platforms. So they don't need a traditional bank account. They can receive these coins as payment for services, and then they can use them to either make face-to-face payments to someone who they know or send money over the internet.
Do you see Libra, again, you mentioned the details aren't all out yet, but do you see Libra potentially being a game changer for the way we buy stuff around the world?
I think it could be, Rob. I think that, again, these major criticisms of existing cryptocurrencies are around volatility and then also ease of use. And Libra seems to address both of those in a pretty compelling way. The other thing that's a barrier to adopting something like Bitcoin is there only really be growth of a currency if a large number of people are using it, right? If I have U.S. dollars and the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker that I work with don't accept U.S. dollars, that's not a useful currency to me. So if I have Libra and I can't go use that at the grocery store, the gas station, or online, it's not going to be very useful to me. And if you look around, there are very few people who accept Bitcoin for traditional goods and services today. I think the fact that we have all of these major companies getting behind Libra means that we might wind up having pretty widespread adoption pretty quickly. So if they can crack that nut and make Libra accepted every place you want to buy and sell items, that this could be the thing that makes this cryptocurrency take off.
As we wrap up, Mike, what are you watching for as this moves closer to becoming a reality?
Well, I'd like to see how the technology is going to work for end users, how easy that's going to be. And then I think the primary concern is around this privacy issue that we discussed. How are people going to feel reassured that they can engage in these transactions online without giving away their personal information?
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks, Rob.
Mike Chappell is an associate teaching professor of information technology, analytics, and operations at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. He's an expert in cybersecurity and online privacy. He joined us today to talk about Facebook's plans to launch a digital currency next year in partnership with a bunch of other companies and organizations. We'd love to hear from you. Are you an early adopter of some form of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, or one of the other less well-known options? Do you think you would use this new thing from Facebook along the way? Or does it puzzle you, frighten you? Do you have worries about it? Let us know your story, your relationship with cryptocurrency, if any. You don't have to share your access codes to Bitcoin. You can do that. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email and tell your story. Our email address is ideas@WPR.org or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think. Now, here's the thing. Ticket sales start this month for a concert tour that's coming to Wisconsin. A couple big names sharing the bill. Roy Orbison and Buddy Holly performing on stage with a backup band. Now, wait a minute. Buddy Holly died in a plane crash in 1959. Roy Orbison passed away back in 1988. So what's going on? Concert goers will see holograms of Holly and Orbison performing their hits using remastered performance audio from both of them. The promo package has quotes from surviving family members giving it their thumbs up, apparently, so that's good. I'm not sure exactly how to feel about this. On the one hand, seems kind of creepy. On the other, it could open up great performers to generations who never got to see them play and let people who did see them relive a great musical moment. I'll think on that, and I'll listen to some Roy Orbison in the meantime. This is Central Time.
I can't help it. I can't help it if I cry.